It's very good to see each of you this morning. As I look around, it's especially good to see some of you. Not that any of you, I suppose, are any more special than others, and I shouldn't say it that way, but mighty good to have you here, Lindsay. Lenny, it's good to have you and your companion this morning. It's encouraging to see you back, and Bob and Virginia. My friend Morris, back in the back, he's been coming by and visiting with me on Thursdays and Fridays, off and on now for a few months, and been talking about maybe he'd come, and he's showed up this morning. That's so encouraging to me, Morris, and I thank you for being here, my friend. I appreciate each of you that I haven't called your name. Our prayer is that the Lord will be here this morning, and that we might be able to worship Him. I'd like to take the same passage of Scripture that we took last week, but certainly don't want to re-preach the same sermon from that passage that we preached last week. In Luke chapter 20, and verse 13, we find these words. Then said the Lord of the vineyard, "What shall I do? I will send my beloved son. It may be they will reverence him when they see him." What shall I do? I will send my beloved son. It may be they will reverence him when they see him. I don't have the power to show him to you this morning, but the Holy Spirit within you has the power to let you see him this morning, and maybe you will reverence him when you see him. Maybe that'll happen here this morning. Maybe it won't. There's been a lot more irreverence in history than there's been reverence. And there's been a lot more apathy and unconcern than there's been irreverence or reverence, probably. There's a whole lot of middle ground there where we do neither. We don't reverence him. Well, we're not irreverencing, but we're not reverencing him. A lot of middle ground there where we're just out here doing something. But maybe you'll see him, and maybe you'll reverence him when you see him, if the Lord this morning will send him. What shall I do? I will send my beloved son. In what situation did he send his son in this parable? You might say, this is just a parable. This didn't really happen. It did really happen. This is a parable. But parables represent real truths, and this did really happen. The Lord did send His beloved Son, and the Lord still sends His beloved sons into your heart. The setting here, to which He sent His Son. A certain man planted a vineyard and set it, let it forth to husbandmen. God Almighty, a vineyard planted by Him, established by Him in a world that we're in. A certain man planted a vineyard and let it forth to husbandmen, and went into a far country for a long time. And at the season, he sent a servant to the husbandmen, and that they should give him of the fruit of the vineyard. But the husbandman beat him and sent him away empty. And again he sent another servant, and they beat him also, and entreated him shamefully, and sent him away empty. And again he sent a third, and they wounded him also, and cast him out. Then said the Lord of the vineyard, what shall I do? What would you have done? If you were almighty, had all power, all strength, all might, controlled the lightning bolts and the fire from heaven and the earth that it could crack open and swallow up individuals, what would you have done to these miserable husbandmen? What shall I do? I shall send my beloved son. That's absurd, almost, in a natural way of thinking. That seems to be an impossible reaction to this situation. What shall I do? I will send my beloved son, and maybe they will reverence him. The father knew what they would do when he sent his son. They'd kill him. But throughout history, there have been a handful. I don't know how big that handful is. It may be the father's handful, and that's a big hand. But there's been a handful of people, it seems almost a remnant sometimes, as we look back through history, but there have been a handful of people who have reverenced that son. Although it seems the vast majority have been on the side that would have killed him, a few have reverenced him. And a few have reverenced the Father for the act of sending him. That son who was sent, what about that son? What's your reaction to that son? Have you heard so much about him that the whole story's become sort of second nature? Are you excited to hear another story about him? From the looks of the crowd today, there's not too many that rejoice in hearing the same old story, but a few show up. I hope you've come to hear the story of Jesus again. But I hope as you've come, it won't just be another Sunday morning that you habitually did what you do on Sunday morning and showed up and do your time and walk away with no difference in feeling. For my friends, when you really see the wonder of this son, when they really saw this son in his capacities, in his greatness, there are words in the scriptures that describe their reaction. They marveled at him. They wondered at him. He was a wonder. We talk about the seven wonders of the world. Here's a wonder. Here's the wonder who made those wonders. They wondered at him. They marveled at him. They were amazed at him. And they were astonished at him. Are those our reactions anymore? Are we amazed at grace? And are we amazed, even beyond the concept of grace, at the grace of the Father who sent His beloved Son into the midst of that situation? Is that amazing? Or is it second nature? I looked up the words in the Greek language. I enjoy doing that. Sometimes you go on a rabbit chase there and don't find much, and sometimes you find something that kind of is worth knowing. When I looked up amaze, let me just read some things to you there quickly about that word amaze and astonish. Amaze and astonish. They're translated in our language. Sometimes the same Greek word is translated amaze, sometimes astonishment, sometimes amazement. Two Greek words, ecstasis, from which the English word ecstasy has been transliterated. Ecstasis. Literally, it means a standing out. What's that mean? It's a displacement, especially with reference to the mind, of that alteration of the normal condition by which the person is thrown into a state of surprise or fear or both. An alteration of the normal state of mind and a displacement of moving from the normal state of mind into another state of mind. Not just a moving, you're thrown into a state of surprise or fear. They were thrown into this new state of mind. This ecstasis, this ecstasy of being thrown into a new state of mind by what just happened. That's what happened to those folks that saw Jesus in action. They were suddenly thrown into a new state of mind. The other Greek word, thambos. Amazement, wonder, terror, astonishment. And it was probably connected with a root word meaning to render unmovable. Now that's strange to me that we've got two Greek words that picture the reaction that people had to Jesus in action. And one of them describes a situation where you're thrown into a new state of mind of wonder and awe and amazement. And the other word describes a person that's just left unmovable. Seems almost opposite, doesn't it? One leaves you unmovable, frozen, where you just can't move, you can't speak, you're just awestruck and frozen in position. That was one reaction. The other reaction, suddenly you're thrown into a new state of mind, displaced into a new state of mind, of surprise and fear and amazement and astonishment. Both words, almost opposite words, but two different reactions to a sudden change of environment, to a sudden fear even, so that sometimes you're frozen in your tracks and sometimes you're just thrown into a new state of mind where you are just awestruck. That's what happens when you really see Jesus, my friends. The wonder, the amazement, the astonishment of this man, Jesus, this beloved Son that was sent. Let's look at His healing power and how people reacted to that. In Matthew, in Mark, in Luke, we have the same story told three times by those three different writers. It's the story of Jesus in a house. Crowded house. Many people surrounding Him. Surrounding Him in the house. Surrounding Him outside the house. Looking in the windows. Door open. There just wasn't any more room to get in there and get to Him. But there were four fellas. Actually five. Four good friends and one sick friend. Four able to get up and go and one paralyzed in a bed. Unmovable. They knew if they could get to this amazing character, they could help their paralyzed friend there. That man sick of the palsy is the way the scriptures describe the disease. He's bedfast. We might call him technically a quadriplegic, perhaps. they can't get to Jesus. There's too many other people getting to Jesus before they got there. And what do? They carry that man and his bed up on the roof. What a thing to do. What determination. What a commitment. And it wasn't for me, it's for my buddy here. I got to get him to Jesus. Oh, he needs him bad. And they climb up on the roof and they start taking the tiles off the roof and they get a big enough hole to lower the bed and the man down to Jesus. I mean, they tore that roof up. I don't know where the owner of the house was. And they let that bed and that man down into the presence of Jesus. Jesus first says, "Thy sins be forgiven thee." Oh, the scoffers at that time said, "Only God can forgive sins." They were talking to God. He first said, "Oh, thy sins be forgiven thee," and then he went on and said, "So that you'll know I have power to forgive sins on earth, I'll say these words likewise. Take up thy bed and walk." And he did. Don't let that go in one ear and out the other. He did. He was paralyzed, bedfast. They just dropped him through the roof in a hole, and he got up and had enough strength in those old legs and in those old arms. It looks like after he'd been wilted and withered that long that it would take a while in rehab, doesn't it, to get back to some strength. He got up and he carried his bed out. No rehab necessary. He was with rehab. Instant rehab. Instant healing. What does it say about that situation? It said they marveled and glorified God, which had given such power to men. That's the way Matthew describes it. They marveled, the multitude marveled and glorified God who had given such power like this to a man. It wasn't just a man, it was his beloved son that had been sent. But they marveled and glorified God that such a power had been given to men. In Mark, we find these words. It says they were amazed and glorified God and said, "We've never seen it on this fashion." I kind of like that. We've never seen anything just on this fashion. We've never seen anything just like this. This is something brand new. This is something wild. This is something that either freeze you in your tracks or move you suddenly into a state of ecstasy. We've never seen it on this fashion. In Luke, it says they were amazed and glorified God and were filled with fear, an amazement and a fear at the same time. They were amazed and glorified God and were filled with fear. And they said there, "We have seen strange things today." What an understatement. Sometimes when there's just such a, there's not anything you can say. Wow, God has sent such power to men. We've never seen it on this fashion. We've seen strange things today. But in each account, they were amazed and marveled and filled with fear and glorified God. They had seen that beloved Son who was sent. When you really see Him, it either freezes you in your tracks or knocks you off your feet. Either way, it's a very reactionary experience to see Jesus Christ. In the book of Matthew chapter 9, verse 8, when the multitudes saw it, they marveled and glorified God, which had given such power to men. Marveled and glorified God. Repeatedly we see that on through the book of Matthew into chapter 15. Places we skip over and places we could go to. If all that He had done had been written in books, the world couldn't hold the books, we're told. In Matthew chapter 15, verse 29. Jesus departed from thence, and came nigh unto the sea of Galilee, and went up into a mountain, and sat down there. And great multitudes came unto him, having with them those that were lame, blind, dumb, maimed, and many others. Many in these categories and many others, and cast them down at Jesus' feet, and he healed them. Multitudes. I don't know how big the number that is, but multitudes is a lot, insomuch that the multitude wondered when they saw the dumb to speak, the maimed to be whole, the lame to walk, the blind to see, and they glorified the God of Israel. Multitudes healed. Multitudes wondered when they saw this. I don't know how many it takes to make a multitude. Let's just make up our multitudes for a few moments as we think about how it might have been if he had come yesterday. And you follow him down to the nursing home down there. And there's the man who's nameless to me, but when we hold services down there, he's confined to a wheelchair. He's dumb, as the word means. He cannot speak. He seems to have very little abilities to move, period, but he can get an arm up and give you the thumbs up while you're talking about Jesus. Now he's sitting there, and there's Ned. Lots of you have seen Ned around town. Ned can't do that, even. Ned's in his wheelchair, and he's got the little controller right there at his lips, and he controls his wheelchair with his teeth, for he can't move anywhere from there down. But while you're preaching, and this one fella's doing this, and Ned's saying, "Amen, amen, brother, amen." And there sits Ned. And there sits Sinath in her wheelchair, just pushed her out of her room because she can't get there on her own, and there she sits in her confinement. And instead of Jeff going in this day, here comes Jesus in there. And he says to those three, "Stand up and walk." And to others that are blind, he says, "I want you to be able to see again." And to those in pain, he suddenly makes it all go away. And the place is empty. And then you follow him over to the other nursing home, and there's Alfred Weir. You walk Alfred to the service real slow. But you won't have to walk him out of the building that day. He can see. He can see. For the first time since he was about 2 years old, the man can see again. Oh, don't you know, it's a good day. How are you reacting to such? Now you leave there and you walk to Madisonville. And you go to Regional Medical Center and you're following Jesus. And he cleans the house over there. And they take the sign down because they don't need that place anymore. And then you may walk from Madisonville to Hopkinsville and go to Western State Mental Hospital. And those troubled characters in that place, the demons are cast out of their minds. And they don't beat their heads against the wall anymore. And they don't have to be protected from killing themselves anymore. Because that which was wrong with them is made right. Because Jesus passed by. How are you feeling by now? And you leave Hopkinsville and you walk to Old Eddyville with him. and all those hardened criminals in that big castle-looking cage. He speaks, and he softens their hearts. And they no longer want to kill Stephen, the preacher. They now bow at the feet of the one who has changed their very nature and say, Lord, what do you want me to do? You say, that's absurd.
It is,
from a natural viewpoint. That's exactly what he did with those multitudes that day. And that's exactly what he still does with old hard spiritual hearts. With healing in his wings, he shows up. Some are healed, and others are amazed and filled with wonder and marvel, awestruck, frozen, or else knocked off their feet. Either way you want to think about it. Both describe what's happened in here as you've seen him come by. This Jesus. Says they were astonished beyond measure in one place. When he raised up that little 12-year-old girl, it says right there, they were astonished with a great astonishment. Couldn't say it any better, just said it twice. Now, sometimes they were astonished, and sometimes they were astonished with a great astonishment. They were astonished when the sick were healed, and they were astonished with a great astonishment when a dead girl got up. Perhaps they'll reverence him. And some did. In John chapter 9, he comes to that man who had been blind from his birth. There's no cure from that. Except one. He took and put clay on his eyes and told him to go wash in the pool of Siloam. And he said, one thing I do know, I was blind and now I see, is what that old boy said a little later. One thing I do know, they were questioning about what he did know, what he didn't know, and whether he was really blind or whether he wasn't really blind. They called his mom and daddy in and said, is this boy your boy? Yeah, he's my boy. You ask him the questions, they say. They don't want to face the mob. That boy that's been made to see who was blind, he said, I don't know a lot of things, but one thing I do know, I was blind and now I see. And he said to them, it's a marvelous thing to me, a marvelous thing to me, that you don't know from whence he came. And you have eyes. But you don't have spiritual eyes, is what he was saying to them right there. It's a marvelous thing to me that you don't know from where he came. He said, it's obvious to me he's come from God. And you're denying that he's come from God. A marvelous thing. They cast that boy from the temple of God that they claim to be their temple. The same temple that in our passage in Luke chapter 20 Jesus had just cleared because it was the Father's temple. They cast that boy from the Father's temple because the Father's Son had healed that boy and he stood up to the Father's Son. He reverenced him. He said, it's a marvelous thing that you don't see what's happened right here. They were blinded and could not see. He had been blind and now he saw. Spiritual blindness. They came in two different occasions. We could go in the scriptures and show you where he healed. And it says they marveled and they wondered. But there were others said, no, it's not really God. It's the devil doing that. Some reverenced. And some stood up and mocked and scoffed and attempted to kill him and did kill him. A different view of the glory of this Son of God. Some wanted to kill him. Some were knocked off their feet by him. How do you feel about him? Can you get a little glimpse of him? Can you see him and know where he came from? And get a glimpse even of who sent him? Do you believe he's the Son of God? If you believe these things, you have spiritual eyes. And not just the eyes of the world. The eyes of the world saw him and killed him. Those with spiritual eyes saw him and were awestruck at what they had seen. If you see him, if you know from whence he came, there's a bit of reverence in you as you see him. That worship comes from God. That's a reassurance that Christ is in you. His power over sickness, over death, his power over the universe, over the wind. He came in one place and they marveled. He came and he put them in the boat and he got in the boat with them and he went to sleep in the hinder part of the boat. And the dreadful storm came and they feared for their lives and they came in and they woke him and said, Master, carest thou not that we perish? And he awoke and he said, Peace, be still. And it said they were filled with amazement that even the wind and the sea heard his voice. In the other place, they were in the boat and he was out of the boat on the mountain praying. And in that situation, he came walking to them on the water. Are you amazed yet? And they looked out and they were filled with fear, for they thought it was a ghost. And he said, Be not afraid, it is I. And Peter said, Lord, if that's really you, let me come to you on the water. And Jesus said, Come. And Peter turned loose the boat, and now Peter's walking on the water. Are you amazed yet? Peter looked away from him and began to sink, but Jesus didn't let him sink. He reached and got him and pulled him out of the waves and put him back in the boat. And Jesus got in the boat, and immediately the boat was to the other side, and the waves had ceased. Are you amazed yet? It says they were filled with a great amazement. And said, Even the wind and the waves hear his voice. In John chapter 3, verse 8, it says, The wind bloweth where it listeth. He controlled the wind once, he controlled the wind again. And I want to tell you something, my friends. He controls the wind again and again and again as the wind bloweth where it listeth. And you don't know from whence it cometh or whither it goeth. So is everyone that is born of the Spirit of God. And what does it say there in John chapter 3 was the reaction when he said those words? Nicodemus answered and said unto him, How can these things be? How can these things be? He controls the universe and the wind thereof. And he controls the spiritual universe and the wind thereof. And when he speaks, you shall hear and shall live, and the wind of his breath bloweth where it listeth. And so it is with everyone that is born of the Spirit of God. The power, the wonder, the greatness of this Son that was sent. It's hard to tell the wonder of him in an hour. I've got pages of notes up here of things I've jotted down about the wonders of Jesus. They wondered at his words and they wondered at his lack of words. There's sermons in these. Pilate, it said, marveled that he answered not a word. He was amazed. He marveled that he didn't say anything. You know, sometimes we'd take a lesson from that and it'd be a marvelous thing. Sometimes if I didn't say anything, instead of blurting out the first thing that comes to my little mind, Pilate marveled that he didn't say anything, but oftentimes they marveled at what he did say. From the time he was 12 years old in that temple with the scribes and the teachers of the law and the brilliant men of the day, and it said that all that heard him, this little 12-year-old boy, were astonished. You see, they were the teachers, but he was the teacher of the teachers. In John chapter 7, it said they marveled, saying, "How knoweth this man letters when he's never been taught?" A man who didn't have to be taught to know. You know, God never went to God's school to become God. He just is what he is. They marveled that he'd never been taught, yet he knew so much. He preached the Sermon on the Mount, and at the close of that it says they were astonished at his doctrine. They marveled, they were astonished, they were amazed. When he taught that rich young ruler to go sell all that he had and to come follow him, and that man left sorrowful. And finally, at the end of that story, that left them all so confused. It left a picture of a hopelessness of ever being saved. That's what he taught right there, the hopelessness of you ever being saved with what you do. There was a lot they didn't know at that point about the lessons of that story. There's a lot I still don't know. But when he got through with that lesson, even Peter and the apostles looked up at him, and it says they were amazed and just simply asked the question, "Who then can be saved?" Who then can be saved? They were so amazed at what the requirements he had given if you wanted to save yourself. And they finally get the point and say then, in amazement, "Who then can be saved?" But he doesn't leave them there. He said, "With God, all things are possible. With man, it's impossible." That was the lesson. But with God, all things are possible. They were amazed at his words, at his doctrines. They said one time, "Never a man spake like this man." They came to him repeatedly to entrap him, and he would come back with an off-the-wall comment or a question of his own, and they'd go back and say, "Never a man spake like this man." They answered not a word to him so many times. And finally it said in this same Luke chapter 20 where we started, it says, "And they durst ask him no more questions." His answers, his teachings. They marveled at the resurrection of the little girl. They were astonished with a great astonishment. They marveled at the resurrection of Jesus Christ. Mary left that place filled with fear and amazement. Peter left that place wondering in himself at the things he had seen. Or maybe he was wondering in himself at the thing he didn't see. There wasn't anybody left in that tomb. Amazed at resurrection. There's a lot in that one too. I wish we didn't have to run over that one so quick. Finally, Jesus would say in John chapter 5, "Marvel not at this. The hour is coming in which you'll see all the graves open and the bodies coming up out of." If you want to see something marvelous, marvel not at what's happening right here. There's a day coming, the resurrection day, when I'll shout and all the graves will open and you'll marvel then. I'll tell you what. Marvel at that sign. Be astonished at his presence. They were. In all the amazement that the Son brought with him, in all the things that he did that cause people to wonder and to marvel, we do find amazement, we do marvel and are astounded by those things. But to me, none of his acts can compare in amazement, as amazing as they are,
not taking away any of his healing, not taking, how can you take something away from somebody that raises up somebody from the dead? How can you say that's less than anything? All those things that astonishing Son did when he was sent don't hold a candle to the amazement in the words, the Father sent his beloved Son. To me, that's the most amazing thing that could be possible. That's more amazing than the amazing. That's more astonishing than the astonishing. Once I've been knocked off my feet by the astonishment of Jesus, and then all of a sudden it hits me, God sent his beloved Son. And that's the most amazing amazement to me that could possibly be. It's too unbelievable to be believable. It's too absurd to be a possibility even, in one way that I think about it. How can something that amazing really have occurred? That the God who could have crushed the keepers of that vineyard chose to send his Son into that wretched vineyard. Not wretched because God had made it wretched. In Isaiah chapter 5, it talks to the well-beloved God who made his vineyard, planted his vineyard, put a hedge around it, watered it, tended it, kept it. What more could I have done for my vineyard than what I have done, it says there. And right after that account in chapter 5, chapter 6 of Isaiah opens with the Father gloriously on that throne. And his train filled the temple. And the doorpost shook, and the cherubims were around that Father. And I think a picture of Jesus Christ stands right there in Isaiah. And that Holy Father who has just in the previous chapter described that wretched vineyard. Woe is that vineyard, he says. And there stands one before that holy, glorious, train-filling temple Father and said, here I am. Send me. What shall I do? I shall send my beloved Son. That's incredible. That was the decision made. Before the foundation of the world, I will send my beloved Son. Did he send the Son? Because he saw something worth sending him for? Was there anything in that vineyard worth even having? Was there anybody that deserved anything from that Father? Was it because of goodness? Was it by request? Was it because he had such a friend in jeopardy? Or somebody that loved him so much down here that he felt some closeness because of that? He didn't send his Son in response to any goodness he saw, any request that came, any love in the hearts of any that were here for him. He sent his Son in response to sin. He looked down in that vineyard in that parable and he saw that they'd rejected and they rejected and they rejected and they rejected him and repeatedly and they'd sinned again. And he said, what shall I do? I'll send my Son in response to that sin. In response to sin, he sent his Son. Repeatedly we find that in Scriptures, Romans chapter 8, verse 3. For what the law could not do in that it was weak through the flesh, the law couldn't save anyone. It wasn't the law's fault. The law was perfect and just and good, we're told in another place. But the weakness was in man, in the flesh. For what the law could not do in that it was weak through the flesh, God sending His own Son in the likeness of sinful flesh and for sin, in response to sin, for sin, He sent His Son. In the beginning, the first response to sin, when God responded to the sin that had just been committed in the Garden of Eden, He said in that response, in His verbal response to sin right there, He said, the seed of the woman will come. I'll send my son. And Satan will bruise his heel. When God verbally responded to the sin that had been committed, his response was, I'll send my son. He not only sent his son into the vineyard, he delivered up his son for us all. God, who spared not his own son, but delivered him up for us all, how will he not with him freely give us all things? Romans 8:32. He delivered him up to the cross. God sent his son. Even the apostles were confounded, amazed, confused, bewildered at such a thought. Mark 10:32. As they were in the way going up to Jerusalem, Jesus went before them, and they were amazed, and as they followed, they were afraid. And he took again the 12 and began to tell them what things should happen unto him. What's the conversation? They're amazed and they're afraid, saying, Behold, we go up to Jerusalem, and the Son of Man shall be delivered up to the chief priests and the scribes, and they shall condemn him to death, and they shall deliver him to the Gentiles, and they shall mock him, and they shall scourge him, and they shall spit upon him, and they shall kill him, and the third day he shall rise again. No. No, it can't be, said Peter. In Matthew, when he taught them those things, they were amazed and filled with wonder and afraid. And Peter stood up, and he should have been like Jesus and answered not a word again, but he stands up and he said, No, these things can't be. That's unbelievable. Peter had just said in Matthew 16 there, Thou art the Christ, the Son of the living God. He knew that. He could accept that. He could be amazed by it, but he could understand that God might send his son in the world. But then when Jesus in that same chapter went on and said, I wish we had time to go over this, in that same Matthew 16, Jesus goes on and said, I've come to die. And Peter said, No, not so, Lord. Not so, Lord. And Jesus said to him, Get thee behind me, Satan. Thou savorest the things of man and not the things of God. The man and Peter couldn't believe it. It can't be that you've come for that. He said, You're listening to your carnal thinking. And you're not listening to the plan of God. Amazing, amazing, beyond amazement. God sent his son in response to sin. Romans 5. For when we were yet without strength, in due time Christ died for the ungodly. Scarcely for a righteous man one might die, or for peradventure a good man might even dare to die, but he didn't send any for any righteous or good man, he sent them for the ungodly. God commendeth his love toward us, in that while we were yet sinners, Christ died for us. What shall I do? I will send my beloved son in response to this sin. I will send my beloved son in the midst of this sin so that these sinners might mock him and will mock him. And some might reverence him, and some will reverence him. And I'll not just send him among them to live for a while. I'll do that. But I'll send him among them, so that by my determinate counsel and foreknowledge, they might kill him. I will send him for the ungodly, in order to make the ungodly godly, and the unrighteous righteous, and the unholy holy, and the unworthy worthy. I'll do that, said God. I'll send my boy. I'll send my son. And I'll send him for sin, and I'll send him for sinners. It's no wonder to the Jews that's a stumbling block, and to the Greeks that's foolishness. But to those who've been called, spoken to by that wind, those who have been called, it's Christ, the power of God and the wisdom of God. Unto us a child is born. Unto us a son is given. Isaiah chapter 9. John chapter 3. God so loved the world that He gave His only begotten Son. What shall I do? I will send my son. Perhaps they'll reverence him. Perhaps they'll reverence me for sending him. Or perhaps they'll scoff and spit on him. Galatians chapter 4, and we'll close. When the fullness of time was come, at just the right time, God sent forth His Son, made of a woman, made under the law, to redeem them that were under the law, that we might receive the adoption of sons. God sent forth His Son at exactly the right time for a particular purpose. That Son was born of a woman and made under that law. First time He'd ever been under anything. He's over everything. But now He's under the law. And He did this in order to redeem them that were under the power of that law and the conviction of that law, in order that they might be adopted to be His sons, His daughters, His children. What a plan. What a plan. I don't know whether to be frozen stiff or knocked off my feet. Perhaps oftentimes I'm not amazed by grace. Every once in a while I get amazed by grace. Every once in a while it's pretty good in this old humdrum world to get amazed. Knocked off your feet or frozen in your tracks. God sent forth His Son, made of a woman, made under the law, to redeem them that were under the law, that we might receive the adoption of sons. And because you are sons, listen to this. You talk about opening up a new can of worms that we don't have time to get into. God hath sent forth the Spirit of His Son into your hearts. That's a whole new story, boys. There's as much glory in that, I suppose, as there is in the first part. In the first part, He sent God the Son. In the second statement there, He sent God the Spirit. Neither less nor greater than the other. The Father sent the Son. And He didn't stop there. He sent the Spirit into your hearts. So you could cry, Father, Father, Abba, Father. He sent His Son to make you a son. And since you are a son, now He sends the Spirit of His nature into your heart so that you can recognize the Father and cry to that Father like those two. Father, Father. So you can see the Father. He sent the Spirit to testify of the Son. If you see the Son, you see the character of the Father. If you have the Spirit, you can see the character of the Father through the Son, and you can cry, Father, Father. And if you can see Father, Son, and Spirit, one of two things ought to happen to you. You ought to be frozen in your tracks or knocked off your feet, one or the other. And the clearer you see them, the more will be that reaction. But you see Him through that Spirit that He sends into your heart, whereby you are able to cry, Abba, Father. Wherefore thou art no more a servant, but you are now a son, a child of God. And if a son or a child, then you are an heir of God through Christ. An inheritance waiting, that eye hath not seen, nor ear heard, nor entered into the heart of man the things the Lord hath prepared for them that love him. Howbeit, then, when you knew not God, you did service unto them which were by nature no gods. But now, after that you have known God, or rather are known of God, how turn ye again to the weak and beggarly elements whereunto you desire again to be in bondage? Have you seen him? Do you know him? Howbeit, then, when you knew not God, you did whatever, whenever, however. But now if you know him, it says here, and it goes on and says, but rather that he knew you first. It makes that point. But if you do now know him, even if it did take him to know you, that he had to know you first, and we love him because he loved us first in so many places, that could lead us in the Scriptures. The question, do you know him? Have you seen him this morning? Have you felt his presence? Been a little bit amazed what you've sensed and felt and known? Then don't turn again, it says there, to the beggarly elements of the world. Don't look there. If you've known him, know him better. Come unto me, learn of me, follow me, hear me. This is life eternal, that you might know the Father and the Son, said Jesus. A bit of life eternal in the midst of this world is available in the church, where we who have got a glimpse of him, perhaps just seen him through a glass darkly. But he's so bright, if you even see him through a glass darkly, you're still seeing some pretty bright light. A brilliant thing, a wonderful, awesome, amazing thing, if you've seen him. Don't return to the beggarly elements of the world, but come closer and closer and closer and see more and more and more of him, and continue for the rest of your days to either be knocked off your feet or stuck in your tracks, one or the other, when you see him. And when you see him, be amazed. But then when you think about the Father sending him, let that grace be truly amazing in your heart. If you've seen him this morning, come to him. In some shape, form, or fashion in your life, make a commitment to come to him. If you haven't been baptized, come to him. If you haven't been walking like should have been walking, come to him. If you haven't been stopping along the way, standing still and seeing the salvation of the Lord, take a moment and come to him. May God richly bless.